You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, what the situations health-wise, environmental-wise are in New Orleans and the other Gulf Coast states that are ravaged by that monster of a hurricane. Avra Van Heerden, John Pardue, and Craig Colton are my guests. 1-800-999-8255. Let me go first and ask about the water that is in that is left. I guess, would it be fair to say that where the water is in New Orleans, and the New Orleans become part of the lake, basically, with the breaches in the dike and the levees over there? Dr. Pardue.
I think that's the case. The water is again slowed because the lake level and the water level in the city have come to some equalization now. So until we pump that water out, you're correct. The city is part of the lake at this point.
And what health dangers does that pose? Or you know, people when they see water, they immediately think, "Uh-oh, mosquitoes."
Well, mosquitoes. We have a West Nile problem here, and that's probably more of a secondary issue down in the weeks ahead. But of course, that water has permeated the homes, the businesses that are in that central area bound by the levees, and so any chemicals or any other toxins that were present on the streets or in the homes or in those businesses have now, of course, seeped out into that flood water. And in addition, the sewer system's compromised. So we any kind of viral or bacterial pathogens that were in the sewer at the time of this disaster are now in the water as well. So those chemical issues and those public health microbial issues are probably, I think, the two health threats that are compounded just the high water itself.
We were talking about restoring the levees and actually making it's possible to build levees that would be functional. But we've been hearing from you and from other experts about having to restore the wetlands and how that might have been able to mitigate some of the storm surge. How do you go about restoring all that land that is missing?
Well, I think that the two things. One is you have to create some diversions in the Mississippi River to allow that natural flow of sediment during the spring floods every year to get out and nourish that wetland and keep it from, as it subsides, and keep it alive. And then we're going to have to do a second thing, which is much more difficult, an engineering problem, which is we've got to get large quantities of sediment into these areas that are subsiding and just rebuild the wetland, much as they've rebuilt areas in Holland, as you mentioned before.
Speaking of which, let me ask Dr. Van Heerden, what about the, I mentioned before, the water and the possibilities of diseases. What other kinds of diseases, the longer the water sits there, can we expect?
Well, obviously anything organic in there is going to start fermenting and putrefying very rapidly. So our initial concern is gastrointestinal diseases. Dr. Pardue mentioned West Nile. We believe probably a few weeks from now we'll see quite a large increase in the numbers. Just imagine being one of those folk on their roofs. The mosquitoes will be tearing them apart every night. Additionally, we're concerned about other mosquito-borne diseases, the principal one being St. Louis encephalitis. And then there's secondary concerns. The local raccoon population is a carrier of rabies. These animals are going to be looking for shelter and food just as the humans are, and there's a potential of them biting humans or biting pets. Obviously, snakes are a big problem. And then we do have a fairly recent immigrant known as the fire ant. It's a very aggressive ant, has a very painful bite. If you get enough bites, you know, you could suffer. So all of that combined, and then, you know, right now there are two big fires in New Orleans. One of them's apparently at a chemical facility. There's a pipeline that seems to have burst, and there's a fire burning at it. So air contamination, anybody who's asthmatic or has respiratory problems is probably right now feeling it.
What about the refugees who are in the other Gulf states? We saw with the devastation in Biloxi, other places, who are basically living in lean-tos or possibly in old abandoned anything that they can find. Are they facing the same threat, the health threats?
Similar, but you know, they don't have the standing contaminated water problem that we do in New Orleans. So their problem is a little bit different.
1-800-989-8255 is a number. Let's go to Mucher in Memphis. Hi.
Hi. How are you, Ira?
Hi.
Great show, as always. Issue here, I'm chairman of an emerging institute at FAMU for the state of Florida. We're doing a public-private partnership, a Semitech type of deal for hurricane-proof construction standards and mold-proof housing. And a big problem that I found, also as a retired global Marsh McLennan partner that ran catastrophe and construction, is that when you go and talk to public officials, it doesn't make any difference whether they're Democrat or Republican, that we cannot get them to be serious about public infrastructure in the United States across the board. And they see us as alarmist. And we have these fabulous academics there, all of which who have given papers and presented ideas, and they've been basically ignored. And, of course, the politicians say, well, we just, you know, our people don't want to pay taxes, and in states like Tennessee, we don't even have a state income tax. So, I mean, this is really a question for the American people. What do they want to do? Do they want to have quality of life in some kind of shared European model where you have world-class infrastructure, where you just want to have decaying infrastructure and the attendant risks that we're living with now? I mean, that's really, really the question. The final issue is the private sector willing to become what I would call responsible collaborators? In the construction industry, it takes 20 years to get them to do anything. And yet in Europe and Finland, they have tons of stuff that'll stand 200-mile-an-hour winds. It's very efficient in pricing, et cetera. The Canadians have technology. There's tons of stuff out there. It's not, things don't even have to be invented. I mean, it's there.
But just getting somebody to, getting a public official who you'll say, they'll say to you perhaps, what are the odds this is going to happen? You'll say 1 in 6,000.
Right.
And well, why should I spend all that money on 1 in 6,000? And then, bam, 1 in 6,000 happens.
That's exactly right. And so now the hope is for all of the collaborators here and across the country is when we come forward, will anyone really be listening, or will they write this off as, well, this is the one thing that will ever happen? Because, of course, they're ignoring the whole global warming phenomenon and the increasing preponderance of for natural disaster in this hemisphere.
Let me get some Ivory, any reaction to that?
My feeling is that the government's going to pay a whole lot more attention to academia after this. Because, you know, we called this, and we've been calling it for a number of years. I think we've been right on with every one of the impacts. I don't think we expected as much violence. But I think maybe now, you know, government will see us as a resource rather than a bunch of geeks trying to get research dollars. You know, New Orleans could be, and certainly, you know, academia is going to try their hardest to be part of it. New Orleans could be the beginning of a new approach to, you know, how we deal with inner city problems, how do we deal with good drainage, how do we deal with a reasonable road infrastructure. And in terms of private industry, they have taken a huge hit with this financial hit. Whether you're insurance, manufacturing, oil and gas, you name it, they've all taken a huge hit. And I think this may be what gels them to take a different approach in the future.
Mm-hmm. Craig Colton, in hurricanes of the past that have hit New Orleans, are usually the same people over and over again the ones who get smashed?
Well, in general, there's been a long-standing pattern of those people with the least resources being the most impacted. Those people have changed over time because, for example, in the Great Flood of 1849, the impoverished immigrants of the day were the Irish, and they lived in the low areas. They suffered terribly during the 2 or 3 months that it took to drain the city then. The African Americans were enslaved at that time. They generally lived in and amidst the neighborhoods where their masters lived, and they generally were on the high ground. Today, the low-income population is largely, not entirely, but largely African American, and they have found themselves living in the least expensive quarters, the least expensive properties, which tends to be, in many cases, the lowest or ill-drained neighborhoods. And so there has been a consistent pattern of low-income populations being most susceptible to flooding and suffering the most in the long run.
There's a saying in the West that water flows toward money. towards money. That isn't the case in New Orleans, is
it? I like to say that in New Orleans, water flows away from money, and those with power and resources tend to live on have the greatest choice about where they live. They can live on this band of higher ground on the natural levee. They have great influence in the political structure to help make sure the higher ground is adequately drained. Those people with the least resources and least voice in politics tend to suffer. Now, in New Orleans, it must be emphasized that there's been an African-American administration in the mayor's office for around 20 years. They have a majority of population in the city. They have a voice, and there have been attempts to improve the drainage system in African-American neighborhoods. It's a slow, gradual process, and even with heavy rainfalls, there's still flooding in some quarters in New Orleans.
1-800-989-8255. Miriam in Madison, hi. Welcome
hi.
To Science Friday.
I have to say that I agree in some ways with the gentleman from Memphis. I have to say that I'm one of those horrible government officials. Government only has as much authority as people are willing to give it. And when you're talking about levies, you can get slammed from both the left and the right because property rights people don't want you to take their property, and they don't want you to tell them what they can and can't do on their property, mm-hmm. they're building in the coast. But the environmental impacts of building levees are incredible, so you're going to have the environmentalists screaming at you. Government only has as much money as people are willing to give it. These things are expensive. Structural responses are extremely expensive when you're looking at flooding. And the focus of where the government goes, that comes from people. And I think it's really fascinating that no one's brought up the shift that occurred within the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the government as a whole after 9/11. You can get dollars like you wouldn't believe for terrorist stuff.
Right.
But you try to get dollars to go out and do an acquisition of a flood home at risk to flooding, it's really impossible. It's difficult. It's extremely difficult. And, no one's talking about that.
Well, there actually have been news reports about the Army Corps of Engineers having had its money for the levees diverted by the government to...
It's not just that. The USGS runs a river gauge system throughout the United States, and that is constantly being cut. There are gauges throughout the U.S. that are being dropped, and these are things that have historical records going back 40, 50 years, and no one's there to pick up that because nobody has any money because there's money always needing to go someplace else. And how are we going to predict? How are we going to be able to make sure that we make good choices for people? Because there's an awful lot of people. I think Mike Brown was correct in some of the things that he said in the last couple of days. People make choices about where they live. I will admit, the people who are poor, who have limited incomes, it's extremely difficult for them. But when you're looking at the Gulfport to Biloxi area, you did not need to put those casinos on the waterfront. And I am extremely bothered by some of the stuff that I'm seeing because those homes shouldn't have been there in many cases.
Let me just remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. And you have people building on floodplains all over America, not just in Biloxi.
Yes, because the National Flood Insurance Program does not tell you cannot build someplace. They simply tell you, if you're going to build here, you must build to certain standards. But those standards are minimum standards. There's no guarantee that you're going to be safe. Yet people constantly, the most expensive property in certain parts of the United States is the coast. You look at New England. You look at Florida. You had 4 hurricanes come through last year, but they're still having a building boom down there. I mean, people do not make rational decisions.
Do you think that this hurricane is going to change those minds?
No. Oh,
no.
People want to be on the coast. They think it's wonderful. They think it's wonderful to be near water. They don't think it's going to happen to them. But if you look at the insurance statistics, you stand a 26% chance of having a claim made on a house in the floodplain with a mortgage over a 30-year period.
Mm-hmm. And coming full circle, though, the people who are most affected by this one, at least in New Orleans, are the people who are certainly not living on those giant, beautiful homes overlooking
New Orleans,
the ocean.
New Orleans is a very different case. I mean, first of all, it's an extremely old city. You can't get people to move from where their sense of place is. But when you look at the new construction that is occurring in the coastal and floodplain areas in the United States, it's truly appalling.
Where do you work in the government?
I currently am working for the state of Wisconsin. I've worked for the state of Massachusetts, and I got my big foot in the water was in 1993 in St. Charles, Missouri, which is the confluence of the Mississippi and Missouri rivers.
So do you think that you're bringing actually a pessimistic viewpoint here is that no matter how bad something is, we're going to forget it. You know, like Martin Luther King said, we're a 10-day nation. And you, when those geeks go back, these scientists, that were, as we were talking about before, and give you the data and ask for the money, they're not going to get it again anyhow.
Well, you know, it's what we're willing to pay for. It's, what are we willing to give up to pay for that? There's only so many dollars that are available to a government, and there's lots of places that it has to go. And you have to sit there and do calculated risks. Mm. And that's what the Corps does, and that's what people do every day. I think you're going to have some people who are going to decide, no, they won't go back. I think you're going to have some places that, yes, they may disappear, which you saw after the 1993 floods in the Mississippi Basin. But you're going to have a lot of people who are going to go back, and you're going to have a lot of people who say, hey, land's cheap. Let's go buy some.
All right. Thanks for calling. Good luck to you.
All right. Bye.
1-800-989-8255, which brings up a question I was thinking of. I'll ask my guests, Ivor Van Heerden, John Pardue, and Craig Colton. Let's say you drain out New Orleans, and I don't know how many weeks or months it's going to take, and people want to go back to their homes. You've shored up the levees. The water has been stopped. Is it a safe thing to tell people to do, knowing that the next hurricane could start it all over again? What do you do as public policy? If you haven't, you know, fixed everything up, you've just put the Band-Aids on, knowing that you're, again, living on something that may be borrowed time.
Looking at historical precedent, after Hurricane Betsy in 1965, people immediately went back to the flooded neighbors. They were crawling out of roofs just exactly as they were in this flood, not over as big an area. But people moved back in, and then they then slowly began the planning process to upgrade the levees along the lakefront to basically where they are now. So they responded. It took 20-plus years, 30 years, but they did move right back in, and people lived with the risk.
But they should, they're willing, we give them the option that they're willing to go back there. I mean, do insurance companies come in and say, I'm not going to insure you if you live here anymore?
That was before the National Flood Insurance Program. Actually, a lot of the housing stock in the Bywater area that was damaged in Betsy, we did an inventory, something like 80% of the housing stock is still in use. Part of the situation in New Orleans is some of these older homes built with cypress, raised on raised piers, are pretty flood-proof.
Yeah.
And they weren't, because there wasn't a wall of water, as in Waveland, there wasn't a storm surge, it was just slowly rising water, the houses were restorable.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but that's not true for all houses in New Orleans, mind you.
All right, hang on there, because we have to take a short break, come back and take more of your questions, talking about the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, and stay with us. We'll be right back.